I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Opioid addiction is a nationwide public health crisis. CDC figures estimate 64,000 people in the U.S. died from drug overdose in 2016. Tens of thousands more suffer from opioid addiction. We've been tackling opioid addiction on many fronts, but there's one approach 9 other countries are using that the United States has not adopted: supervised or safe injection facilities. After looking into safe injection facilities in Canada and Australia, the Massachusetts Medical Society released a report that found supervised injection sites can reduce overdose mortality and increase access to drug treatment. Later in the hour, the chair of the Massachusetts Medical Society joins us to explain why the society is so supportive of establishing a safe injection facility pilot program in Massachusetts. But first, what can we learn from the operation of safe injection facilities in other countries, and what would it take to open them in the United States and even here in Massachusetts? Joining us in Woods Hole is Ray Tomasi, former president and CEO of Gosnold on Cape Cod. Welcome. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Mindy. Thank you.
In addition to your work at Gosnold, you're also part of Governor Baker's Opioid Addiction Working Group and the Prevention Commission. So what are, you've been working on this, what do you see some of the positive steps that we've taken so far in Massachusetts to address opioid addiction?
Well, I think if we look back over the last 3 years, I think the Opioid Commission was chartered in 2015, if I remember. We met for about a year. We had a time-limited series of meetings. We came up with 65 recommendations to submit to the governor, and those recommendations covered everything from treatment, some prevention, prescribing patterns, education, all that sort of thing. Of those 65, I dare say that I think there are only 5 or 6 of those that haven't been incorporated into legislation that has been passed. There's been a lot of bipartisan support for these efforts. So I think Massachusetts, as I sort of travel around the country and talk to other folks who are working in this area, Massachusetts is far ahead. Now, having said that, you know, the penetration to the overdose death rate, even though it went down last year, has been slow. We've seen a reduction in the number of prescribed opioid pills that have been out there, about a 20% reduction. There's still a lot of access to those medications, and doctors are coming along and adopting new prescribing patterns. So I think the efforts along multiple fronts, the prescribing front really is about, can we reduce the number of addictive opioid pills that are out there? So as soon as you sort of begin to shrink access and availability, the presumption is you'll have fewer people entering the pipeline for abuse and dependency. On the treatment side, there have been treatment beds added. There's been improved access to care, and there's been a different sort of perception about what actually constitutes improving treatment. I think initially it was about, we need to get more beds because people need to be getting into treatment. But the whole system in Massachusetts was built around emergencies and crises. That's basically, I call the detox an emergency room for addiction. And so initially the focus was, let's have more of those beds. But it's tantamount to saying, we're going to improve people's health by making emergency rooms bigger. No one would do that in the absence of a more comprehensive downstream policy. And that started to happen. So we started to be thinking about, okay, if you look at the data, we said on the commission, we looked at the data and said, wow, 50% of the people who go to detox are the same people in the same year. And of those who do go to a detox, 88% have been there before. So maybe we should start paying attention to how we can prevent people from regressing and returning to detox. That led to the development of this idea of community-based recovery coaching. Can we support people in the community? Because you don't want to create a system that has individuals relegated to residential or treatment inpatient places. People want to be functioning in life. So there's been a good move toward that. And so there's been a good effort on that side. And I think on the prevention side, the front side, how can we not just educate, but better be able to identify risk and then intervene with those who are more likely to develop problems with alcohol or drugs as they age? Because essentially what we do now is we wait until people get to that point. And then when they get in a crisis, they call up and they say, well, I need to get someplace today. And the system obviously is never able to sort of respond to that kind of immediate urgency every time, all the time. So there have been a lot of efforts. And as Dennis may say later, of course, the Mass Medical Society has been supportive. We've improved education in medical schools because heretofore, most physicians really didn't know very much about addiction, pain management. It was not a high priority in medical colleges. So I think on a number of fronts, we've made progress. But this is a problem that was in the making for 20 years. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to turn it around in one
overnight,
or two.
Yeah. When you're talking about the education and prevention, I'm wondering from the young people's perspective. I know several times we've had some younger people in their 20s who were in recovery, and they've always said, I didn't realize the road I was down. I didn't, and I thought, did we stop doing drug education in schools? I would say these, the ones I'm thinking of, were not raised in Massachusetts, but still, it seems like we could do a better job educating kids on you know, what this stuff does.
Right. Education alone, educating people about the dangers of certain drugs or how certain drugs affect you, have a very poor transmission to behavioral change. You know, we've been doing education, you know, been teaching kids about, here's alcohol, guys, you know, the district attorney would come in, these are the drugs, watch out. That's a very limited kind of a short-term approach. I think the better practices, and this is what we're starting to do now, is to initiate screenings, be able to identify those from screenings that are reliable instruments, that who is more likely to suffer from not necessarily substance use disorder at age 8, mm-hmm. but who may have patterns in their presentation in schools. Maybe they score higher on an anxiety scale, or maybe they. So if you do those kinds of screenings, because we know that there are certain typologies that are more likely to develop addiction. The biggest one is, do you have a family history? Mm-hmm. And in at least probably half the cases,
most everybody have a family history with alcohol?
You know, and there's genetic predisposition. They haven't really, they've been able to say, I think there are 70 different genes that could be implicated. So it's a long way until mm-hmm. you get to that kind of a thing where CRISPR might be implemented and you take the gene. But so there are indicators, and we saw in our own experience very good outcomes when we embedded a clinical person into a pediatrician's office, screened everybody, and then you could start to see this kid is a low risk, this kid is a moderate risk, this kid is a high risk because he scored high on a different scale. So when you begin this is really all it is early identification and intervention at a level that may be more successful in preventing progression to more serious consequential activities. And so it's fine to educate, but you have to do more than that. To help kids understand how to deal with risk averse responses.
Have safe injection facilities been discussed with the opioid addiction working group? Was that ever come up?
It may have had a passing comment, but it was not a serious consideration by mm-hmm. the group at all. No.
Do you know, has the governor weighed in on that at all, up to your knowledge?
I believe the governor's position is the jury is still out. I mean, the governor has made it very clear that everything is on the table in this crisis. Everything is on the table. You can't summarily dismiss anything. But relative to supervise, I don't refer to them as safe injection sites. That seems to me, in the context of injecting an illicit drug that you really don't even know what it is, because people bring their own heroin in there. So it's a supervised injection site. I think he's still leaning no, but I haven't read any of his recent comments.
All right. Joining us from our studios at WGBH is Carl Scartino. He's the executive director of the AIDS Action Committee. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
So can you explain exactly what a safe injection facility is and how it works?
Sure. Well, I think it's important to know that these are being used around the world very successfully to prevent overdoses. In most cases, they're essentially a clinical site where people who are in the throes of addiction can go and consume their own pre-obtained drugs under clinical supervision. This might seem like a radical concept to a lot of people, But the reality is we have people consuming drugs, injecting drugs in communities across the state with no lifeline. And that's why we see the escalating death rate that is happening.
So, and to be clear, we're not providing the drugs. This would be, as you're saying, people are bringing in their own.
Yes, exactly. And one of the services that these centers can provide is fentanyl test strips. We see fentanyl is very highly potent compared to even heroin and much more likely to cause an overdose. So for people accessing services, they need to know how risky are the drugs that they're actually consuming. When they're on the streets on their own, they have no way of doing that. And that's when they are using alone, they're most likely to be dying. One of the things, when we look at this at a community level, we have public consumption of drugs in parks and cemeteries and public bathrooms. We have people overdosing in isolation across the state. We see very high rates of cost to the healthcare system, emergency rooms, ambulance, first responders. That's all mitigated by actually providing supervised clinical spaces where people can consume drugs. This is not a perfect solution. Obviously, we want to get people into treatment and prevent people from getting addicted in the first place. But we're talking about an addiction that has a high relapse rate. And when people are on the streets, our job number one is to keep them alive. If they're not alive, they have no hope for treatment.
Ray, do you see safe injection facilities, or supervised, as you like to call injection facilities, being part of our approach to addressing the opioid addiction crisis?
I think they may have a very limited place in a larger kind of approach to the addiction problem in the country. I think to some extent the sort of good news that gets reported out of SISs is a little inflated and isolated. The fact of the matter is, yes, if you're in a supervised site with nurses and medical personnel in the area, you're going to prevent an overdose. You prevent the death because you respond to the overdose. That's sort of undeniable. You can't sort of deny that. Does it have an impact on the overdose death rate? It does in the site, but the downtown east side is generally in Vancouver is off. This has been around since 2003, I think. I'm not sure. But the fact of the matter is overdose deaths in Vancouver have steadily climbed. In fact, in 2017, Vancouver had more overdose deaths than they've ever had. So that gives me some pause. Is this a solution? No. And I think, as Carl just mentioned, it's not a solution. It's one little piece. So I would sort of narrow my endorsement. I don't even want to do it, because what I see this is basically above and beyond the immediate thing. We know that cases of AIDS are reduced. You've got clean needles. All of those things are obvious in that particular area. It hasn't had a significant impact over long term on crime in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. There's still actually a little bit. In some areas, crime has gone up. It has affected that neighborhood. So I see it almost like palliative care for people who have been relegated to a life of injecting heroin. Mm.
I think it's important to note what happened in Vancouver, though, because it did open in 2003 and it's been well studied. And in the immediate geographic area around Insight, which is the program there, they saw a significant reduction in overdose deaths in the geographic area surrounding it. And you're right, since 2017, the numbers have gone up in overdose deaths Vancouver citywide. But that's why Vancouver is actually moving to open more supervised consumption sites, because what happens when you're dealing with a population that is homeless and marginalized and dealing with drug addiction, they're not traveling across the city to go to these sites. And Vancouver is not immune, like Massachusetts is not immune. We are seeing an escalating rate of drug consumption, of injection drug use. The fentanyl supply across the board is driving those deaths. So the solution isn't to say SIFs or supervised consumption sites aren't working. The solution is to say we actually need to make them accessible to people where they're using and dying. And I think until we do that and grapple with that reality, we want to pretend that prevention and treatment are the only two solutions, but they're not. And in the meantime, people that are addicted and not yet ready for treatment or are relapsing need to be able to survive. And these are the only proven effective way is to harm reduction programs that help them survive.
Well, that certainly there, I would agree with part of that, but I think there's another. There are other things to be taken into consideration. And often, when we talk about what other countries are doing, and there are many countries that are doing a lot more, and some of those countries have much more developed social welfare states. Their culture is a little different. But often what's pointed to as a very successful place that has, and the data supports it, is Portugal. And so if you look at Portugal, they've had very, very good results with their approach to drug addiction. Interestingly enough, when I was sort of looking at some of the details about Portugal, they don't have supervised injection sites. But what they have done is they have made a major commitment to invest in prevention, treatment, research. They decriminalized the drug use. And so the whole idea of pushing people through the criminal justice system, and I think that we're getting there. But Portugal, but see, and they did a massive campaign to educate the general public to reduce stigma. I think that's been done very well in Massachusetts. We still have it, and it's going to be here through a generation. It takes a long time for that to wash out. So I would say that if we incorporate supervised injection sites into a comprehensive plan, that plan is going to require a major investment of resources, dollars, workforce, and programmatic ingenuity and innovation to change the way we think about and treat addiction in this country. If we do that, I think on a temporary basis, SISs have a place. I wouldn't want to see, okay, Vancouver has one. Now, the Insight area, and that's in that little small area, you've had a reduction in a lot of things, including crime, but you have a much more increased police presence there. But apart from that, so now that works. So let's put one over here. Why not just create the whole? I mean, where do you stop? And so it's not so much about those. It's about thinking about them in the isolation of those sites, and that's what this country has not made that commitment.
Carl, there are 9 other countries, including Canada, Australia, and several European countries, who have adopted these sites. So, and then we're hearing Ray talking about what's happening in Portugal. So, what do we learn from these experiences in terms of what we might want to be proposing here?
Well, I think the key lesson is that they actually do work in saving lives. They reduce public consumption, they reduce overdose deaths in the community, and they are a gateway for treatment programs. The Vancouver site saw a 33% increase in accessing detox and behavioral health services through that program. We've run 2 needle exchanges ourselves here at AIDS Action, and what we see with our clients every day is they're coming in off the streets. Most of them are homeless. They're coming in for syringes, for Narcan, really for a safe place to get off the streets and dealing with the addiction that they have. And we're able to provide them a whole range of services, testing, clean syringes, Narcan, access to behavioral health and treatment navigation services. But at the end of the day, when the cravings hit them and they're ready to use, we have to send them out the door. And they go find an alley or a public bathroom and they overdose and die. We were able to reverse almost 300 overdoses last year in our program. But we had lots of other clients and people in the community, obviously across the state, almost 2,000 people last year, 6 people a day were dying. These programs, I think Ray is spot on. These are not a solution in and of themselves. They need to be a part of a broader, comprehensive solution. The problem that we see here, though, politically in Massachusetts and across the country, is every other solution is being engaged in, whether it's law enforcement with fentanyl trafficking or treatment access with insurance or treatment bed capacity. Harm reduction and SIFs in particular are considered sort of a third rail. And I think it's in large part because it makes people uncomfortable, mm-hmm. right? It makes people uncomfortable to think that we're providing a space where someone would be injecting drugs. But the reality is it's happening every day in every community across the state in a very unsafe way that's leading to escalating death rates. And the death rate came down a little bit the last year and a half or so. But the overdose rate's not coming down. That we're not getting ahead of this. It's skyrocketed over the last decade. And I think it's important for us to remember we're going to be with this issue for many more years to come, and we're losing a generation right now.
We're talking about the possibility of safe injection facilities here in Massachusetts. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the possibility of safe injection facilities here in Massachusetts. In studio with me is Ray Tomasi, a former CEO and president of Gosnold on Cape Cod. And from our studio WGBH in Boston is Carl Scartino. He's the executive director of the AIDS Action Committee. Ray, you wanted to chime in before we went to the break.
Yeah, I did want to comment on the data that came out of the Lancet study that Carl cited regarding a 30% referral to treatment of folks who go to the site. And I think there are two ways to look at that. The number was essentially 2,100. There were 2,100 referrals to treatment out of the Insight during the period studied. But if you look at that 2,100 against the number of actual admissions or visits to the site, there were 243,000 admissions or visits to the site during that period. So depending upon what denominator you use, if you said we had 243,000 visits and 2,100 of those visits ended up in a referral to a treatment place, that's actually, that's less than 1%. So I don't know how aggressively these folks were pushing treatment, because one of the things you want to do in that setting is to create an environment where people feel welcome and able to come in there without being pressured. Otherwise, they won't come at all, and then you lose on both sides. So I'm not sure that the referral rate is really as good as it was purported to be in that research. And then what we know about people who get referred to treatment is that probably 30 to 40% of them get to treatment. And of those, maybe half actually complete treatment. So when you start to sort of break this down, I'm not sure that the referral to treatment number is that great in those mm-hmm. sites. And you got to harken back to the gross data, which is what is the trend of overdose death rates in a place like Vancouver, where they have one and they will have others, it continues to rise. Now, as Carl correctly points out, a lot of that is due to the last 2 years and the presence of fentanyl in these mm-hmm. drugs. I mean, folks are using drugs that they buy from dealers right. somewhere else, so you don't really know what they get. So my question would be, is someone thinking about the next step, which would be a little frightening to me, and that is, like, why complicate this by having people use drugs that they buy from a dealer? Why not just give them more pure samples or more pure versions of the drug? So now we actually would be supplying them with heroin that we know is unadulterated. Is that the next place to go? And what does that say about the society's position about people who suffer with an illness? Yeah. It's a very tricky slope.
Yeah. So first responders, including police, fire, EMTs, are on the front lines of dealing with an overdose. And I don't know if either of you know the answer to this. Have they weighed in on safe injection sites? What do we know what their thoughts are?
There hasn't been a formal statement from any of the associations. We do know that the first responder calls go down where SIFs are in place, because people don't need to be calling 911 to go to the emergency room. We are in active conversations with a number of local law enforcement and first responder organizations in particular communities in the state as we look at SIFs. I think one of the issues that we're going to have to grapple with, even if we're successful in getting the legislation passed that we're working on, is it still requires buy-in at the local level and making sure that we have the right location with the right infrastructure in place. Even our needle exchanges right now, we have to work hand in hand with the local police and EMTs to make sure that we operate in a safe way, in a way that is collaborative and addresses the needs of the community. That's going to have to be a part of this dialogue as well.
Mm. We know that drug sellers target treatment facilities. Is there evidence that they'd also target safe injection facilities?
In terms of law enforcement issues, cracking down on them?
Well, I'm just, you know, we've heard that, you know, when the, and Ray, you probably would know more about this, drug sellers look, you know, a lot of people who come into treatment get high before they come in, and so drug dealers know that, and we've, you know, heard that they target these areas. Would that be the same thing for a safe injection?
Well, I mean, I think the inside experience has been that that hasn't been the case, but we have to remember that the area, the 4-block area around Insight, has been heavily policed. So
you need an increased police presence.
So I mean, I guess theoretically you could say if you reduced the drug trafficking in a 4 or 5 or 6 block area by increasing police presence in that area 10 or 20 fold, whatever it was, then I guess someone could say, I wouldn't, but why don't you just do that in the rest of the community? Then you won't have that problem. But the surrounding neighborhood in that area, one of the things that really struck me is that in the area immediately around the Insight, the city dropped the speed limit to 25 miles an hour because they were concerned about persons who were under the influence, addicted individuals who were just sort of staggering around the area, were not going to get hit by a car. So, I mean, I haven't been out there, but it doesn't sound like the best option to me.
But that's exactly what we have right now in Boston streets, where we have hotspots where people are shooting up in the streets, getting access to drugs because it's cheap and easy to get on our streets of Boston and across the state, frankly. And there are neighborhoods where you can see in certain public parks and hotspots where there's active drug transactions going on, there's active public injecting going on. That's already our really dismal reality. And I think part of our challenge is to say, that's our reality. How do we move from that to a place where people are not dying in our streets and help them get access to treatment? You know, if you go to Melnia Cass in Boston, it's become sort of notorious for this, but it's not the only spot, of course. The homeless camps on the Cape that have been really targeted and shut down in a lot of places were notorious in that context for public consumption of drugs and overdose deaths. I think the law enforcement attempts to end the drug trade have clearly failed, and I don't think there are many people that would argue that the war on drugs, so-called, has been a dismal failure. But I don't think you need to go to the extreme of Portugal, per se. I would be very curious to see that model and explore it more. But I think the reality is we have public consumption, public death, and we have a treatment system that's broken. We have a disease of relapse with a high rate of relapse, and our job is to figure out how to be honest about that reality. We're losing our loved ones, our kids, our neighbors, and we have to take a really hard look. It really is reminiscent of the worst days of the AIDS crisis. Mm-hmm. You know, when we had high rates of death from the AIDS crisis in the early and mid-90s especially, that is when Massachusetts took the leap forward and legalized needle exchanges at a time when those were considered to be radical, at the time when having a drug paraphernalia, a syringe with drug paraphernalia was illegal. We took that leap forward because people were dying, and that's exactly where we are today.
But what we did, and of course I don't want to tread because you know this better than I do, Carl, but there was, but when the AIDS crisis hit us, it wasn't a, there was the top line story was not let's have needle exchange programs. The top line story was let's get busy and invest the dollars it takes to research what might be an effective antidote to this. Let's begin to start to change the whole culture of how people think about this disease. And let's recognize that it's a disease that it's an illness that affects everyone, not just a small segment of a population that was highly stigmatized at the time. There was a massive movement. It was that massive movement of advocacy, primarily on the part of gay individuals, that got the AIDS issue to the front side and really led to a comprehensive approach, not a limited thing, but let's say, let's just have clean needles.
Let's bring on Dr. Dennis Dimitri, a physician and chair of the Massachusetts Medical Society. Good morning, Dr. Dimitri.
Good morning.
So why is the Massachusetts Medical Society supportive of a safe injection facility pilot program?
Well, we've taken a close look at a number of different ways to approach this opioid overdose crisis, and we think that it's important that all the viable tools that are available to us be examined, and safe injection facilities are one of them. Now, let me just say right up front that obviously this is a controversial issue, and that in an ideal world, it would be best if nobody was injecting illicit drugs. But we also need to temper that idealism with a little bit of realism, which is that there will always be some people who are going to be injecting drugs, and we need to figure out ways to deal with that in addition to some of the traditional approaches of abstinence that have been tried before, in addition to certainly the advocacy for medication-assisted treatment for people with substance use disorder. But there's a population for whom safe injection facilities may be a way to transition them from a very difficult position into being better able to access care for their substance use disorder. So we've taken a careful look at some of the experiences that have been out there. We know that for probably the better part of a couple of decades in Western Europe, a number of countries have used the approach of ranging from decriminalization, as was mentioned earlier in Portugal, to at least creating facilities where individuals can inject drugs in a safe and supervised fashion and be moved towards treatment. The downside to the Western European experience is that most of the information about what happened there is anecdotal. Fortunately, we have had the opportunity to take a look at some very solid research out of the Insight facility in Vancouver, Canada, which has also been running for close to 20 years now. And the data there was very convincing to us that facilities that provided safe injection sites for individuals were not associated with an increased first use of injection drugs, were definitely associated with greater referrals for treatment for substance use disorder, decreased the annoyance factors of people injecting in public, of needles being discarded in public places. There was no evidence that there was an increase in crime in the areas where the safe injection facility was located. So when we looked at the data, at the evidence, we became convinced that it would be worthwhile to pursue a pilot project here in Massachusetts and to study the outcomes of that pilot very carefully to make sure that the success that was seen in Vancouver is translatable to the Commonwealth.
And to be clear, the Massachusetts Medical Society would not be operating an SIF pilot program. So who do you think is in the best position to do that?
So our position is that this is something that needs to be done by a state agency because of the very complex ethical issues, regulatory issues, legal issues. You know, frankly, it is not legal to be in the presence of heroin right now. So there are both state and federal laws that would need to be overcome. And only a state agency with the support of legislation would be able to do that. So the Mass Medical Society supports the concept and would love to work with a state agency on this. But that's really where the lead needs to come from. Mm-hmm.
So what criteria would be used to evaluate the pilot program?
I think we would want to be sure that we could reproduce some of the data that that we've seen out there already. In other words, is there indeed a decrease in the number of people who die from overdoses in the area surrounding the safe injection facility? Is there a decrease in people injecting in public spaces, discarding needles in public parks? And very importantly, do we see an increase in the number of people who are successfully transitioned to treatment for their substance use disorder?
So how do you see safe injection sites fitting into an addiction treatment model?
Well, there are those individuals who, for instance, their addiction is mostly by taking prescription pills that they've purloined or gotten by other means. And for those individuals, a safe injection facility probably doesn't play much of a role. Those are individuals who can be treated in primary care settings with medication-assisted treatment. But the safe injection facilities are probably going to be mostly utilized and important for some of the most marginalized members of our society. society who are injecting IV drugs. These tend to oftentimes be individuals who are more likely to be homeless, to be unemployed, to have no health insurance, to have few personal or family support mechanisms. So this is not something that is an answer for everybody, but for this particular population, it can be an additional tool to help them with their illness.
Is the American Medical Association in support of safe injection facilities?
So the Mass Medical Society came out in support of this the spring of last year, and then we shared our report on safe injection facilities with the AMA, and a resolution was brought to the governing body of the AMA last summer, and at their annual meeting, policy was passed in support of the concept of pilot programs for safe injection facilities in the United States. So yes, there is some support from this for this from national organizations such as the AMA.
We are talking about the possibility of safe injection facilities pilot program in Massachusetts. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the possibility of a safe injection facility pilot program here in Massachusetts. In studio with me is Ray Tomasi, former CEO and president of Gosnold on Cape Cod. And he's also on Governor Baker's Opioid Addiction Working Group and Prevention Commission. In our studio at WGBH is Carl Scartino. He's the executive director of the AIDS Action Committee. And on the phone is Dr. Dennis Dimitri, physician and chair of the Massachusetts Medical Society. Now, Ray, Dr. Dimitri talked about a little bit contradictory to something you said earlier about the crime in the Vancouver area. Do we have different reports here? What did your?
I think it's not as rosy a report. I mean, I think there are mixed. You know, I looked at the data from the Vancouver Police Department, 2002-2016, and there were three or four major categories. Assaults in 2002 in that area were 784. In 2016, there were 1,248. Breaking and enterings were down from 669 to 562. Thefts had increased from 981 to 1715. Auto theft down, vehicle theft down. Overall, in those five areas of criminal activity, 4,827 events in 2002, 5,471 in 2016. I would say, and I don't want to sound like the contrarian here, but because I agree with Dennis and with Carl about some of the very sort of essential points here, but let's face it, supervised injection sites accomplish only one thing. Now, it's a big only one thing. They prevent people from dying of overdose in the site. We haven't talked about outside the site. However, the overall addiction rate in Vancouver or anywhere else has not gone down. Crime has not gone down appreciably. And most importantly, overdose deaths have increased year over year in Vancouver. Now, you could say, as Carl's suggesting, well, we need more of those sites. Mm-hmm. I guess the question then is, where do you stop? And so in thinking about this on the longer continuum of what is a comprehensive system to treat this disease, supervised injection sites, in my view, have a very small place in that continuum. And I'd want to get the best minds together to think about how do you really develop a prevention, treatment, and recovery system, and a research program that aims at really eradicating this in a much more way, and not relegating a small percentage of people to a life of absolute misery. Mm. I don't care if you're shooting heroin in a supervised injection site. It's a bad life, and it doesn't lead to a productive, enriched experience.
Dr. Dimitri?
Well, I, you know, the last thing that was just mentioned, I certainly agree with fully. You know, being in the throes of a disease like severe substance use disorder is indeed a miserable way for one to continue to lead one's life. And as I said earlier, for those individuals in that extreme situation, that's primarily where safe injection facilities are going to fit in. I think that there are a couple other things I didn't mention that are benefits of safe injection facilities, and that is that there's been shown to be a reduction in the kinds of unsafe practices that increase the risk of spread of diseases such as HIV, hepatitis C, hepatitis B, et cetera. So there's some potential for medical improvement in medical outcomes as well. The ultimate goal, of course, is to improve the research around what is it that allows people to become addicted? Why are some people more prone to this? What are better methodologies for treatment and getting people cured from their addictions? But that's a long-term outcome. In the short term, we think that safe injection facilities do have a track record for saving lives, and the first step you need to do to get people into treatment is keep them alive. I'll make one other comment about the rise in overdoses, and we've seen this here in Massachusetts as well, that there seems to be a correlation between an increased availability of fentanyl in street drugs and the rise in people dying from overdoses. And this is a totally different issue than has been faced before. From some of the reading I've done, that felt in Vancouver that one of the reasons why they've had some bump in overdoses more recently is because of the introduction of fentanyl into their city, where that didn't exist before. So that's a separate issue, one where perhaps law enforcement does play somewhat more of a role in terms of trying to shut down the source of fentanyl entering the United States. Hmm.
All right, let's bring State Representative for the Cape and Islands, Dylan Fernandez, on, who's on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy. Thanks for having this conversation.
Sure. So there are some in Beacon Hill who are trying to make safe injection sites a reality in Massachusetts, but there seems to be a lot of pushback both within the legislature and from the governor. So bring us up to speed on what's happening.
Sure. So the House took up a comprehensive opioid bill a couple weeks ago. I filed an amendment for a safe use site in Massachusetts. That didn't go through. The Senate also filed in their bill a safe use amendment, and that got reduced to a study. So right now, as the bills are being reconciled in conference committee, we are sending around a letter for House members to sign on in support of a safe injection or safe use program study in the final version of the bill so that we can, you know, better get evidence as to the efficacy of these sites and how it would play out in Massachusetts. And I think when thinking about safe use sites, you know, the study is, you know, it looks at the health benefits and risks. It looks at existing harm reduction here in Massachusetts. And importantly, it looks at the implications of federal and state and local laws in implementing these sites, because we know that these are currently illegal on the federal level, but I believe needle exchanges used to be illegal on the federal level in Massachusetts in the mid-90s, implemented a needle exchange pilot program in communities across our state that really helped reduce harm and reduce debilitating diseases. But when you look at this overall, I mean, Massachusetts spends hundreds of millions of dollars on the opioid and heroin epidemic. The CDC estimates that it costs our state nearly $2 billion a year. And frankly, after all of this investment, we don't really have a whole lot to show for it. Overdose deaths have tapered off slightly, but within those numbers, deaths from fentanyl are actually rising. And so, you know, 2,000 people die a year. It's a huge loss to our society and, more importantly, their families and friends, and that's a dollar figure you can't put a number on. And so these safe injection sites, safe use sites, are just another tool in the toolbox that we should be exploring in Massachusetts. And they've shown through data to save lives, reduce infectious diseases, and help those suffering from addiction get treatment. And that's why the Mass Medical Society, American Medical Society, support them. And to think that just the stigma of this disease is so great in Massachusetts, a state that's supposed to be without stigma, that we can't even put forward a pilot program to take a closer look, I think is heartbreaking.
So you're mentioning that this is against federal law. So are there other states trying to initiate similar programs? And
That's a great question. So not at the state level, but on the city level, you've seen several cities move forward with these sites, among them New York and San Francisco. It's really no surprise. You know, unfortunately, the U.S. Attorney Lelling signaled that he would not support these in Massachusetts. But the Trump administration has, you know, long made clear that they, will ignore facts and science and data. It's no surprise that, you know, an administration that doesn't believe in climate change would not believe in evidence-based approaches to addiction recovery. But this is, I still think Massachusetts has a chance to lead here. And, you know, frankly, why can't we put forward something that is proven through data to save lives and get those who need treatment into treatment? And I don't support this, you know, philosophically. I've just looked at the data, and the data is just compelling to me. It's compelling to people in the field that these sites can have a serious role in preventing overdose deaths.
Okay, I want to bring Ray back in for a second here. Yeah, let's say that they were able to pass this legislation and get this. Where are you going to put it? I mean, you could see even people would say, yeah, this is a great idea, but who's going to want it in their neighborhood? Is that going to be a problem?
No one. And if they go to the InSight neighborhood in Vancouver, they'll be mortified. But I guess the good thing about this conversation is that introducing the concept as a possible place in a system. But let's not overstate the outstanding data results, because in fact, for instance, homelessness, it's 57% increase in Vancouver from 2005 to 2017. There were 1,364 homeless individuals there in 2005. There are 2,138 in 2017. So homelessness increased. Crime did not significantly go down, even in the neighborhood where they had the police presence. Overall addiction rates did not go down. Overdose deaths have increased year over year, 20% to 25%. Now, admittedly, the sort of the Chinese fentanyl stuff has made it a lot worse. And the neighborhood in that area is absolutely deteriorated. So let's not ignore, if we're going to think about this, I would say it would be one part of a much more comprehensive bill to address these other issues around social determinants and helping people make the transition. Because, frankly, only 1% of the people who of the admissions into that InSight center during the study period got the treatment, right? Not 30%.
Dylan, I'm going to let you have the last word. You have a couple minutes here.
Sure. Yeah, I don't think anyone would argue against that. And no one's saying that this is, you know, a silver bullet, and all we're asking for is a single pilot program. You know, obviously we need to expand beds, expand prevention, expand insurance coverage, and expand research for evidence-based approaches. But this is just another tool in the toolbox. And I think, we should be exploring everything. We need creative and disruptive ideas to really get at this epidemic. And there is so much at stake here. You know, a lot of people that I went to school with have suffered from this this morphine molecule. You know, 2,000 people are dying a year. We need to explore everything, and every option should be on the table. And you know, the fact that nearly a dozen developed countries across the world have implemented these sites and have seen positive results is something I don't think that we can ignore. But again, it's just another tool in the toolbox. And, you know, also, you can't really just cherry pick, you know, statistics from an entire city. It's like saying you put a safe injection site in, you know, the South End that reduced opioid deaths by 35% and increased detoxification service by 33%. But then if addiction rate in all of Boston climbs, saying that they don't work, I mean, that's just not really how statistics work.
All right, we have to leave it there. State Representative Dylan Fernandez, Dr. Dennis Dimitri, physician and chair of the Massachusetts Medical Society, Carl Scartino, executive director of the AIDS Action Committee, and Ray Tomasi, former CEO and president of Gosnold on Cape Cod. Thank you all for sharing your viewpoints with us this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank
great
you.
Conversation.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.